Topic number 2. The Rockefeller-Soviet alliance, which has just come apart, was indispensable to the Rockefeller plot to control the world. This was the master stroke that enabled the Rockefellers to follow up their destruction of the British Empire with an active menace that would prevent a revival of Britain and Europe as powerful, independent rivals. The final phase of all this was to be Nuclear War I, primarily on American soil. It was to kill tens of millions of Americans, yet it was to be a programmed, limited nuclear war, with the outcome decided ahead of time. In the aftermath, the Rockefellers were to have been enthroned as America's absolute dictators. Europe and Britain were to be absorbed into the Soviet orbit of control, exhausted from energy and other shortages, but virtually unscathed by war itself. That was the deal between the Rockefeller brothers and the Kremlin partners. But true to their tradition, the Rockefellers had a double cross up their sleeve as the culmination of Nuclear War I. To prepare for the war, their plan was to denude America of most of its military power while building up an awesome military machine in the Soviet Union. When the programmed war came, it would be so destructive and America's plight so helpless that despair would seize us all. But then, in our darkest hour, with half of America's population gone, the secret moon base, bristling with particle beam weapons, would come to the rescue. In the space of at most a few days, Soviet military forces worldwide were to be destroyed, and vast numbers of Russians were to die in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was not supposed to know about this final act. Instead, they were to be caught by surprise and utterly destroyed. And after the fact, the plan was not to tell the world about the moon base. Instead, the Rockefellers would emerge as the only organized power on Earth, and they would attribute it all to, quote, divine intervention, unquote. By this stratagem, they expected to deceive the world, or most of us, to accept their rule as divinely ordained. In this way, they were to become the final heirs of the secret commitment for a one-world government that was set in motion so long ago. In 1924, John D. Rockefeller, Jr., the father of the four Rockefeller brothers, talked of his dream of the day when, quote, "No one will speak of my country, but we will speak of our world," unquote. And on January 31, 1945, before the Protestant Council of New York City, he delivered an address entitled "The Christian Church, What of Its Future?" In this speech, he expounded one of his favorite topics, the need as he saw it, for the Christian Church as we know it to be replaced with something more suitable as the direct outcome of the very conflicts which the Rockefeller Empire itself had secretly spawned. Praising the self-sacrifice and loyalty of millions whose lives were being ruined and snuffed out, Rockefeller painted it all as a wonderful crusade. With growing enthusiasm, he said, "What an opportunity, what a privilege, what a duty." The nightmare of world war, in other words, was merely a necessary prelude to the future status he envisioned for the Christian Church. Quote, "It would be the Church of the Living God," unquote. It would be devoid of all, quote, "ordinance, ritual, creed, all non-essential," unquote. Stripped of its camouflage, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. was reviving the ancient concept of the God-King, the ruler who is to be worshipped and who can do no wrong. But unknown to the Rockefellers until very recently, the Soviet Union found out years ago about the final Rockefeller plan to destroy them in a double cross by means of the moon base. That is why the Soviet Union initiated a crash program to develop a particle beam of their own 10 years ago. And this is why they launched such massive efforts in civil defense 5 years ago. This is why the Soviet Union tried to surprise the Rockefellers over a year ago with their own double cross during the summer of 1976, beginning with the underwater nuclear missile crises. As of a year ago, the particle beam weapons race was very close, but it appeared that the Rockefeller moon base would win. As an interim blackmail system, the Rockefellers had arranged for the CIA supermissiles to be planted in the oceans by the Glomar Explorer and other means, as I first revealed in AUDIO LETTER 20 for January 1977. But as of now, only two of these CIA supermissiles, Atlantic Missiles No. 1 and 2, are still operational, all the rest having been ruined by gradual corrosion and leakage. By now, the Rockefellers expected to have their secret moon base operational, rendering the CIA blackmail missiles obsolete. The Kremlin was afraid that the Rockefellers were going to succeed, dooming the Soviet Union to certain disaster at the hands of the moon base. So they decided to strike first in a surprise attack. The result was the Soviet underwater missile crisis of 1976, described in AUDIO LETTERS 14 through 16, July through September 1976. As I described in AUDIO LETTER 16, a Soviet missile-laden mini-sub became trapped in Chesapeake Bay in late September 1976. It was our perfect opportunity to blow the whistle and stop the entire Soviet program of preparation for surprise attack by making it public. But as I detailed in AUDIO LETTER 17 for October 1976, this chance was thrown away by President Gerald Ford and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger in their Red Friday Agreement arranged at the White House with Andrei Gromyko 1 year ago tomorrow. At the time, such an abject capitulation seemed as incomprehensible as it was treasonous. Later, I learned of the CIA supermissiles, which the Rockefellers continued to hold as a club over the head of the Kremlin, and it made more sense. But only now, in the light of the moon base and the Rockefeller plan for a final double-cross, does it all make sense. The Rockefeller brothers thought that they could assure themselves of surviving the war and expected to have the moon base ready to destroy the Soviet Union at will. Under these conditions, the more horrendous the warfare up to the point of their falsified divine intervention, the better from their point of view. Their objective was total control, including the spiritual deception of millions. The Soviets, meanwhile, were preparing for a doomsday approach, that is, to be in a position to threaten such total destruction worldwide with all their underwater nuclear weapons that the Rockefellers would be afraid to trigger all-out war by using the moon base. But 3 days ago, on the night of the harvest moon, September 27, 1977, it all unraveled. America lost the Battle of the Harvest Moon. That same day, Tuesday, September 27, 1977, Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko delivered an ultimatum to the United States in a speech at the United Nations. A few days earlier, the Soviet Navy had expelled all British and French fishing trawlers from the Barents Sea. And as Gromyko spoke, the Barents Sea was filling up with scores of Soviet submarines, massing in preparation for deployment into the North Atlantic. And at the same time, the huge Pacific Soviet submarine fleet was massing in the Sea of Okhotsk off the southwest tip of the Kamchatka Peninsula for deployment into the North Pacific. And on top of that, six more particle beam satellites were being readied for launch from four Soviet cosmodromes, one each at Baikonur and Tyuratam, and two each at Kapustin Yar and Plesetsk, two particle beam satellites, Cosmos 929 and another, were already in orbit by that time. At the United Nations, Gromyko denounced the fact that relations between the United States and the Soviet Union have entered a period of, quote, stagnation, if not a downright slump, unquote. Then he demanded that a new agreement limiting nuclear arms be arrived at, quote, without any delay, unquote. Most people did not recognize this as a veiled ultimatum, but the Rockefellers did. Gromyko added that the Soviet Union is now ready to halt underground nuclear tests for a while, even if others do not. The reason for this statement, which surprised everyone, is that the particle beam has now superseded all nuclear weapons as a front line of Soviet armaments. That evening, an unusual nighttime meeting with Jimmy Carter was hastily arranged at the White House at Gromyko's demand. The Rockefeller major media went out of their way to portray this unexpected meeting as a good thing, despite Gromyko's very harsh words at the United Nations, with breathless assurance that a breakthrough had apparently been achieved toward a new SALT accord. But that, my friends, was not Gromyko's message at all. Boiled down to his essentials, here's what Gromyko told Carter and Vance on the night of the Harvest Moon, September 27, 1977. We, the Soviet Union, have today destroyed the American moon base, which your sponsors had planned to use against us in the coming war. Now it is we who are in command, and now we will oblige you with the war you have been working so hard to bring about. The war will now be fought on our terms, not yours. But you are to give no hint publicly about any of this. If you do, I am instructed to inform you that you and your sponsors will forfeit your status in America as well as your lives. The following day, the massed Soviet submarine fleets began moving out of the Barents Sea and the Sea of Okhotsk, bound respectively for the east and west coasts of the United States. Other Soviet submarines were also ordered to converge on our country from positions worldwide. Yesterday, Jimmy Carter held a news conference in which he did his best to obey Gromyko's instructions. His eyes puffy from sedation and lack of sleep, he talked about anything and everything. But he exposed the glowing CBS and other reports of 2 days earlier about an alleged SALT breakthrough for what they were, with the words, quote, an immediate agreement is not in prospect, unquote. And in his opening remarks, inserted in the context of energy matters, he blurted out, quote, the reason that we have to act is not because we have crises or emergencies at this present time, but because they are imminent, unquote. And today, after a hurried meeting with Secretary of State Vance in New York, Gromyko left for Moscow. Meanwhile, our space program has suddenly fallen on hard times. Yesterday, for the second time in 2 weeks, after many years of faultless launchings, an American rocket abruptly exploded during launch. This one, an Atlas Centaur, happened to be carrying an important communication satellite to be stationed over the Indian Ocean. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union launched Salyut 6, and there are signs that now at long last the Soviet Union will decide to go to the moon. After all, there is no longer anyone there to stop them, and the possibility exists that very soon there will once again be a particle beam weapons base on the moon to menace the Earth, this time controlled by the Soviet Union. And just today, the Houston NASA Space Center activities having to do with the American moon base were shut down. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union has planted a total of at least 60 cobalt bombs in the sea worldwide for the generation of earthquakes by their cumulative effect. Several of these have been set off already, 3 near Indonesia, 4 in the Aleutian Trench, 3 in mid-Pacific west of California, and 1 in the Mediterranean some distance from Crete. Others are still planted along the Aleutians, in east-west fracture zones in the Pacific and Atlantic, in the Indian Ocean, including several west of Australia, around the Bismarck Archipelago northeast of Australia, near Panama, in the Mediterranean and the Caribbean, and in the Gulf of California. On Monday, the SALT I agreement expires. The next day, October 4th, is the 20th anniversary of Sputnik 1, and it also marks the completion of the 5-year plan for civil defense in the Soviet Union. By October 7, if not before, the United States will be surrounded along our east, west, and Gulf coasts by almost the entire Soviet submarine fleet. As I say these words, 29 Soviet submarines have already arrived on location in the Gulf of Mexico. These, like the Atlantic and Pacific fleets, which are converging on America in a pincers movement, are armed with missiles carrying neutron warheads. There are well over 100 submarines in each of the 2 Soviet fleets that are heading here from Russia. This is by far the most massive and rapid deployment ever of the Soviet submarine fleet. As I mentioned last month, NATO considers the deployment to sea of the Soviet fleet as one of its most important signals that a conflict is about to begin. Therefore, my friends, I would not be doing my duty if I did not warn you that a national emergency and possibly war itself may be virtually upon us. Topic number 3. 181 years ago this month, on September 17, 1796, George Washington delivered his farewell address as the first President of the United States of America. Washington truly loved the infant nation he had led to freedom and believed we would become, at no distant period, a great nation. As that great nation, his dream was that we would give to mankind the magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence. Washington left us with various warnings about pitfalls to be avoided, such as overgrown military establishments and foreign entanglements. But he went beyond that to urge upon us a positive pattern of behavior that would be unique in the world. Concerning foreign affairs, he said, "Observe good faith and justice toward all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all." Regarding the public trust of government officials, he said, "I hold the maxim no less applicable to public than to private affairs, that honesty is always the best policy." And as the bedrock of his other convictions, Washington stated firmly, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." Washington's ideals to guide America were a revolutionary departure from Machiavelli's rules of power, which had been spelled out 2 centuries earlier. According to Machiavelli, the first rule of any ruler who wants to keep and increase his power must be to ignore all moral laws. False promises, continual deception and lies, betrayal of allies who have served their purpose, and regular deliberate wars are the keys to success, according to Machiavelli. For a century, Washington's words generally prevailed over those of Machiavelli in America, and our nation grew and prospered as none before it. The main exception to this was the Civil War, which was provoked partly by foreign intrigue into our affairs. And great European powers, primarily Britain and France, were preparing to intervene in our hour of strife and destroy our nation altogether. In this black hour, President Abraham Lincoln turned to what was then the greatest Christian nation on earth, Russia. Tsar Alexander II greatly admired the United States and dreamed of transforming Russia's government into something similar in a step-by-step process. After receiving the sealed message from Lincoln, he said to the American envoy, quote, "Before we open this paper or know its contents, we grant any request it may contain. On the day on which your president was inaugurated, we, Alexander II of Russia, signed the protocol which liberated 23 million serfs. Abraham Lincoln, President of the United States, has freed 4 million slaves. Therefore, whatever he asks of Russia, Russia will grant, for Alexander II will not be a factor in the enslavement of any man." Unquote. In the autumn of 1863, at a critical tide in the war, the Russian Navy suddenly swarmed into the harbors of New York and San Francisco and anchored there. It was a dramatic, powerful signal to all other powers on earth to stay out of the Civil War, and stay out they did, with the result that despite our horrible self-inflicted wounds, the United States did survive as a free and independent nation. From that time onward, Russia was targeted for total destruction by the secret international powers, who have been thwarted in their design to bring the United States under their control. They decided that Christian Russia must die, to be taken over by a godless new governing system called communism, established by the international financiers themselves. Meanwhile, financial allies were promoted within the United States also for conquest from within. Thus, little-known ties began developing after the Civil War between the Rockefellers, the Morgans, and the Carnegies of America and the Rothschilds and other power brokers of Europe and the world. Shortly before the Spanish-American War, a quiet revolution took place in American foreign policy thanks to these secret international connections. Washington's dream for America was exchanged for the nightmare of Machiavellian politics. Soon the Spanish-American War was on, brought about by the deliberate sacrificing of American lives in the explosion of the battleship Maine. The fact that Spain had been genuinely trying to avoid a war made no difference. To the cries of "Remember the Maine," America went off to war. After the smoke cleared, it eventually came out that the war had been unnecessary, but the American people were puffed up with being suddenly a world power. The former Spanish possessions of Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines now lay in American hands. Most Americans were too pleased with America's new prestige to worry about the immorality of what we had done. And with that, 80 years ago, the American people began to sell their soul. By 1904, there was a further shiver of things to come. As part of the secret agreements preventing America's new Pacific possessions from being disturbed by the Japanese, we sat by while Russia, the country that had saved the United States from extinction 4 decades earlier, suffered a Pearl Harbor-type attack. The Russian fleet, peacefully at anchor at Port Arthur, was attacked without warning by cracked Japanese warships and torn to shreds with heavy casualties. But the reaction among most Americans was not horror, but a thrill at this great exploit. 37 years later, a very similar attack on Pearl Harbor would be denounced by all Americans as a day of infamy. But in 1904, it was happening to someone else, so it was all right. Step by step, for 80 years, the American people have gradually blinded themselves to the truth by failing to cherish or look for it. And so we have been led to slaughter time and again, never learning from our experiences. In 1898, it was "Remember the Maine." In 1917, it was "Remember the Lusitania and the Sussex." In 1941, it was "Remember Pearl Harbor." And now, in 1977, we are being set up for the cry of "Remember the Panama Canal." only this time it will be different. In 1917 and afterward, we repaid our brothers in Russia by sitting idly by as a Christian nation died. During our Civil War, Russia had saved the United States from destruction by forbidding outside intervention. But in the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, it was outside intervention by American financiers that sealed Russia's fate. And we as a people sat idly by, acquiescing as the United States government began propping up the satanic new government that caused the deaths of over 20 million Christians. Over a period of 60 years, a Frankenstein monster has been built before our very eyes, the Soviet Union, and we as a people have done nothing whatsoever to stop it. Now the Soviet Frankenstein is turning on us, and we as a people are left without excuse for whatever may happen. Those who have refused to use their time and resources for the common good of our nation need not expect to use their money now to escape to some safe haven. There is none. Even Switzerland, with the best civil defense installations on earth outside the Soviet Union, has already been sabotaged by Soviet nuclear mines in Lakes Geneva, Zurich, Zug, Lucerne, Wallenstadt, Zernin, Brienz, Thun, Neuchâtel, Locarno, and Lugano. My friends, there will be salvation for some in this hour of trial, but it will be on an individual basis. Those who love the truth, and who love our Lord Jesus the Christ, and who have tried will not be deserted. But for those who do survive, I can only repeat what I said 2.5 years ago in conclusion to my tape on the Fort Knox Gold Scandal. It is only those of us who have tried our best who will have peace in our hearts and answers for our enslaved children. Until next month, if God wills it, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God protect each and every one of you.